This fall at Washburn University in Topeka, potential young voters followed the scent of free donuts to the student union, where their peers tried to get them registered to vote if they weren't already. But a surprising number of students here were registered. At Washburn and 16 other Kansas colleges studied by Tufts University, there was a really significant jump in student turnout at the polls between 2014 and 2018. So we're talking midterm elections. Experts say this is a trend to watch heading into 2020, and politicians ignore young people at their peril.
Campaigns will rue the day that they take them for granted, whereas, to be honest, you can sort of take older voters for granted. I mean, those over 50 voters, boy, I mean, they show up.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is Something Central Standard will be following between now and November. Let's start with the reporter who brought us this news out of Kansas, Celia Yopis-Jepson of the Kansas News Service. Hi, Celia.
Hi, Gina.
So let's back up. Tufts University studied voter turnout on 17 Kansas college campuses, and they saw a big jump midterm to midterm, not just in registration, but in actual turnout at the polls, and this mirrored national trends. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so not every college participates. You have to agree to it. But Tufts, they study about 1,000 campuses nationwide. And so they looked at 17 in Kansas. And like you said, all of those colleges in Kansas saw voter turnout increase in 2018 from 2014.
By a lot.
By a lot. So here are the schools that saw their turnout jump more than 20 percentage points in Kansas. KU, K-State, Emporia State, Johnson County Community College. I mean, that's a massive jump. And nationally, college voting doubled in 2018. So we're looking at, 40% of students on these 1,000 campuses voting. Now, it's worth noting that's still lower than the overall voting rate, that, 15% of people of all ages voted. So college students still less likely to vote, but a significant increase.
What do they think accounts for that increase?
So Tufts did actually ask students. They did a national survey. They can't speak specifically to Kansas. But what college students told them nationally is that they were really motivated. They had strong feelings about things like gun violence, climate change, President Donald Trump. Here in Kansas, of course, we did have some really high-profile races. We had the governor's race, for example, with a nationally known high-profile Republican candidate, Kris Kobach, running against a woman who had a lot of experience here in state legislation, Laura Kelly, who won. What experts are saying is that they're saying nationally, young people seem really interested in getting out the vote for female candidates that they really hope could increase representation in government, and also candidates of color that they really believe in. Of course, here in the Kansas City area, you may want to talk about the Yoder Sharice Davids race, I think. Similar thing going on there. These are high-profile races that maybe drew young people to the polls.
So what are the projections for this trend continuing or not into the 2020 presidential election?
So that's where everyone's going to debate what happens next. This is the huge question. You had that quote from a professor I spoke to at Washburn University who says kind of like, okay, anyone who wants to predict what young voters are going to do, good luck, because historically it doesn't seem to be that easy to predict. And candidates that think like, ha, we've got this vote, sealed and ready to go.
Like, I mean, can I just say, it doesn't seem like we're that great at predicting what voters are going to do, yeah. Period. Yet we try.
That may be true, but no. So here's what's interesting that we know will happen. There's this kind of vicious cycle that normally what we know is that people are more likely to vote if candidates reach out to them. They get exposure to campaigns, right? But campaigns reach out to people based on if they have voting records. And guess who doesn't have voting records? 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds. So that perpetuates the cycle that younger people don't vote because campaigns aren't reaching out to them because they haven't voted. Now, this time, we saw a surge in 2018 of young people setting their voting records, right? They have a voting record now. So what we know is that more of them are going to hear from campaigns for the 2020 election, and that could then spur more of them to go back to the polls.
There was this so-called purpling of Kansas in 2018 in the midterms, with the victory of Sharice Davids really seeming to a lot of people like an indicator that things are shifting politically in Kansas. do the experts see a correlation between that trend and increased turnout among young people? Because this rallying cry of, like, we need to get the young voters out in 2020 seems particularly loud from the left.
Well, I think what it fits with is research that shows that young people in general lean more left than the population overall. They're more likely to vote Democrat than the population overall. So, yes, I think, you know, there is a link to the extent that younger people do tend to, and not all. I talked to young people across the political spectrum, but they tend to lean more Democrat. So when you saw figures like Laura Kelly and Sharice David stepping forward and getting a lot of attention, you know, it would seem that maybe that's what energized a lot of young voters.
In your story, you did talk to a libertarian who had been disinterested in voting at one time because of how unlikely it was that a libertarian candidate would ever win. But something had activated her and changed her mind. And she was not just registered to vote. She was participating in Get Out the Vote efforts on her campus. Can you tell me more about her and that whole story?
Yeah, that's Emporia State University. They had the best turnout numbers that I saw in the state. And that university has really worked hard on it for, oh gosh, I think a decade. So the professors there have really talked to their students of it doesn't matter where you are on the political spectrum. Do you want your voice to be heard in government or not? And I think they've had a lot of luck getting students to really think about the fact that they can't shape the, you know, the candidates and government overall unless they vote and talk to their friends about voting. And so I did talk to students from Emporia State with different, you know, political beliefs and backgrounds who were all excited to vote.
Let's bring some other voices in on this. In 2018, Rock the Vote's Carolyn DeWitt came to Kansas for a big event at K-State. We talked to her then about projections heading into the midterm, and now she joins us again. Carolyn, dare I say you told us so about this spike in voter turnout.
I loved the comment earlier about we don't do a very good job about predicting voters in general, but what we were seeing last year turned out to be true is just this generation in particular, in the time that we are in, they are showing up and being heard. And next year, I think we can continue to see that trend continue.
Before we get too deep into this, remind us of the guiding principle of Rock the Vote. It's not a partisan rocking of the vote you're suggesting, right?
Correct. Yeah. Rock the Vote is a nonpartisan nonprofit that works to build young people's political power. Young people historically turn out at lower rates than older generations. And the main reason for that is they're simply new voters. And so, as Celia talked about, they're not being necessarily reached and engaged because they don't have the voting record. But also, you know, the laws and voting policies can be complicated. And so young people a lot of times need the extra help and information to understand the importance of their vote and how to navigate the process.
So some scaffolding, really.
Correct.
To get involved.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
When someone feels really strongly about politics in a partisan way at a really partisan time in our country, how do you make the case for a youth vote that isn't based on a specific outcome of the election for one side or the other?
So a healthy democracy promotes participation, right? It depends on the participation of its of the people that govern, right? It governs, and so when we see that large percentages of populations aren't voting, their values, their ideas, their wants for the future aren't reflected in our government. And so that is something that we need to correct about our democracy, is that voices of individuals, of voters, are actually heard.
So just as a statement of the health of our democracy.
Yes, absolutely.
But the lesson of 2018 in Kansas anyway does seem to be that change can happen at the polls and young voters can have a lot to do with that.
That's correct. Yeah. I mean, you in Kansas, I mean, I think you guys can even speak to it more than I can. But, you know, Kansas was kind of the home for the war on voting prior to 2018. And so you saw in really great groups like Loud Light and other youth groups and campuses really activate and have make sure that young people were empowered with information about the importance of their participation and really, you know, show up at the polls. And that resulted in a lot of changes and a lot of new direction for the state and for local governments.
This is partly on an issue-by-issue basis, right? Because something like climate change, for example, older people think of that as a partisan issue. And it's my understanding that, by and large, young people do not. They see climate change as an urgent problem demanding attention, and they see it that way on whichever side of the political spectrum.
Yeah, that's correct. So young people are really interesting. One, they're not single issue voters. They're very sophisticated. They don't see these issues or the solutions to solving them in silos. They know if you want to talk about healthcare, you have to talk about women's reproductive rights. If you want to talk about economic justice, you have to address access to affordable higher ed. You know, you can't talk about gun violence without discussing democracy reform. And so they really are looking for a vision and solutions that are addressing all of these critical issue and urgent issues that we're facing. And the fascinating thing about young people is, no matter where they pretty much fall in the political spectrum, they're looking for common sense solutions to these challenges, because they know that we've ignored them or put band-aids on them for so long that we need to address them urgently, or we're going to suffer the consequences.
And they specifically are going to suffer the
yes,
consequences.
Exactly.
You know, in Celia's story, she heard from experts who said that this is really a matter of which issues candidates prioritize and actually address, because in order to get young voters' attention. So it's like student debt mattering as much as Social Security.
I go back to this. I do think that there are issues that young people are feeling more intensely. Climate change, obviously, especially with the extreme natural disasters that we're seeing right now, and global warming. And gun violence, of course, is a major issue that's affecting communities. I mean, just in Kansas alone, you've had over the last year several instances in, you know, bars and on shooting on campuses. And so I do think that there are issues that young people are feeling need to be addressed more urgently. But again, I don't think that they see these as individual issues. They know that the solutions to solving these have to address other issues if they're going to be holistic approaches.
Celia Yopis-Jepson, jump back in here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, the students I talk to. Definitely some issues seem to be forefront in their mind, like student debt, which you can really understand when you're in college, you know.
Accruing the debt in real time.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be a big thing that's on a lot of people's minds, right? You're accruing debt and you're wondering how much you're going to earn for that. I did hear a range of different issues from students in terms of what's concerning them.
Like what hasn't come up already?
Issues in that
range that we haven't already kind of talked about that may surprise some of our listeners.
Well, one thing that I did also hear is, a concern from, students who told me that they plan to vote Republican, that they don't trust the news media, and that they think that there is a lot of fake news out there. So we haven't mentioned that yet. I would say, yeah, that's another I heard.
We're going to take a short break. Call 816-235-2888 to join our conversation. With memories of how the political process looked to you when you were young and whether that's changed, or if you are a young voter now, tell us what it'll take to get you to the polls in 2020. When we return, we'll hear from a young voter who's been talking to other young voters for her perspective. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I've been talking to Rock the Vote's Carolyn DeWitt, as well as Celia Yopis-Jepson of the Kansas News Service, about young voter turnout in 2018 in Kansas and what it does or doesn't tell us about the youth vote headed into 2020. You can join that conversation at 816-235-2888. We are particularly interested in hearing from young voters, but if you are an older voter who has memories of your own trajectory and your own, you know, being activated to vote or not as a younger person, we want to hear from you too. 2888. My next guest is Anita Austin. She works for Loudlight, which is a Topeka-based organization that does registration drives across the state of Kansas. And Anita, I've been describing you as a young voter. How old are you?
I'm actually 31.
So we should discuss whether that is like what we even mean by young voters, because we've been looking at college campuses, and you're going to talk to us about what you're hearing on college campuses. But young can mean a lot of things to a lot of people, and the youth vote does not exist solely on college campuses.
Yeah, absolutely. And we definitely do a lot of work and do a big push on college campuses. But you're correct in that there's so many young people who aren't in college that are in the voting block that are also participating at higher rates. And it's definitely been a big increase in the past election cycle of turnout in that age group of voters.
So before we get into what you're hearing in your travels across Kansas, can you tell me the story of how you became passionate about voting?
Yeah, well, I fell in love with public policy in college. And after having different internships and government jobs, I wound up at the nonprofit I work at now, Loudlight. And just having the opportunity to encourage people to be involved is something I've always been really passionate about.
Do you consider yourself a young voter at 30, 31?
That I feel as if I'm on the cusp. That's what I would say.
The website for Loudlight has this graphic on it that I find compelling and a little disturbing. When you go to loudlight.org, the words that appear on the screen are, "We don't have representation." And then it shows two pie charts, one showing the percentage of the U.S. electorate that turned out versus staying home in 2018. It shows 47, and then the other, I should say, showing the percentage of youth who voted or not in 2018. It shows 47% of the overall electorate not voting and 68% of youth not voting. So all the happy news of increased turnout in 2018 still looks pretty grim when you're not just seeing it as compared to 2014.
Yes, absolutely. So, and that was definitely a feeling I had getting back the data from the last election cycle. It was, wow, we've got this amazing increase in youth voter turnout, and that increase still only brings us up to 30-40%, which is still less than half of youth voters. And that's why I think this work is extremely important, because even though we are making progress towards this goal, we are very far from realizing the goal of true representation.
What concerns you about young people specifically not turning out?
Young people represent such a large portion of the voting bloc and the population. They're the ones that are going to experience these policies. And so that's something that just makes it key for their voices to be heard.
What are the issues that you're hearing a lot about as you travel around campus visiting or around the state visiting campuses?
Yeah, so I hear a ton of concern about climate policy, which was something you mentioned earlier in the show. I also agree that not all young people are one-sided. I've spoken to college Republicans who are concerned about immigration, who are concerned about, like, gun rights. But we also see a lot of, you know, people wanting marijuana reform, people wanting student loan reform. So the issues are really across the board.
Are there things that you've heard that surprised you, even being someone pretty close to the age of the people you're talking about?
Yes, I do think that there's a narrative that all young people are very liberal, and even though studies show that a large amount of them are, and maybe even the majority of them are, there's still quite a bit of discourse, and I think that was something very surprising to me to see how many people lean the other way, and how many young people there are that, you know, those ideals are still important to them.
What are folks on both sides of that spectrum saying about their plans to vote or not in 2020?
So I absolutely think that what's going on in the news in the nation with the presidency, with so much on the next election, I think that everybody is going to push for their issues. So everyone's voting very issue-based.
As opposed to party-based.
Right, right.
Carolyn DeWitt of Rock the Vote, jump back in here.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think the trends that we saw from last year have not died down. We continue to see young people incredibly engaged, incredibly loud about, you know, what's going on both with the issues that they care about, but also the attacks that we've seen on democracy. So one of the things I want to bring up is, because following this wave of youth activism and voting in 2018, we've seen aggressive efforts to suppress young voters, more so than we even have in the past. And so one of the things that we're really focused on is making sure that, you know, young voters next year, who will comprise between millennials and Gen Z, they'll comprise nearly 40% of the electorate, which is huge.
That is huge.
Yes, they have incredible power to, you know, decide the direction of our communities, of our country. But we need to make sure that they can actually have access to that democracy, that they can have, you know, exercise their freedom and their right to vote.
When you say that there are aggressive efforts to suppress the youth vote, can you describe what you're talking about?
Sure. So we're seeing increased voter purging. Of course, this is happening across the country, so I'm not speaking specifically about Kansas, but we're seeing increased voter purging. So since the 2016 election, we've seen over 17 million voters purged from the rolls. And in the last few months, we've seen court cases that have allowed voter purging to happen. We're seeing increasing ID requirements and pushes for ID requirements. We're seeing a lot of pushback on ballot measures that were passed in 2018 that had public support behind them. We're also seeing in some states them trying to, you know, lawmakers trying to ban and remove polling places from campuses. And we're also seeing some lawmakers even call into question the right to vote of out-of-state college students.
So can you explain a little bit, when you talk about voter ID, why would increased requirements relating to voter ID target young people in specific?
Sure. So it broadly targets young people, people of color, transient population, so people who are moving constantly. I mean, as young people, particularly if you're on a campus and you're going, you know, from dorm to dorm or moving off campus or whatever it is, you're not necessarily updating your driver's license every time, right? If you are going away at college, you might still have your ID from home and not have updated your ID to your college address. And so therefore, what happens is you go to vote or you go to register at your campus address or wherever you've moved, and you aren't able to vote there because it doesn't match the polling place that you're trying to vote at.
So we should say, you know, we've talked a lot about young voters and student voters as kind of like the same population, and not all young voters are on college campuses. Will you talk to me about the non-college-based youth vote and how that might be different or not from what we've been talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's worth noting there's actually a decrease in enrollment in colleges in many states. So the idea that all young people are college students is actually a misnomer. But we have a growing and very sad and unfortunate growing homeless population among young people. We have young people who, you know, are still living at home in their parents' home or out in apartments and in group homes that, you know, are harder to access, quite frankly, because they don't have an institution that is, you know, trying to get them to participate in voting. And so finding them actually through other channels, so whether it's, you know, through work, we actually do a lot of partnerships with companies to register and mobilize their employees, a lot of youth brands who employ young people. It's also online, and using social media is a huge way to reach young people. I mean, that's actually the number one way that young people find out about an election is through social media, a lot of times through their peers or through organizations like Loudlight or Rock the Vote, who are purposely reaching out to them.
Celia Yopis-Jepson, in your reporting, you heard about kind of a feedback loop between who turns out to vote and whose issues get addressed. Can you talk about that a little more?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just the concept that we touched on a little bit, that if you are not part of the electorate that's voting, then our candidate's really going to be responsive to you once they're elected. And I do want to kind of take a little bit of a side kind of
Little detour.
Yeah, a little detour here, because you're talking about the youth vote that are not on college campuses.
Yeah.
And the experts I talked to said that that's why it's really important to increase education at the high school level and do more outreach there. I mean, there are a lot of seniors that are turning 18 before they leave high school. But either way, those kids will all be voters someday, right? And we know that a lot of them will never set foot on a college campus. So that's really the better time, or an important time to reach
a time
them.
To access more people.
Yeah, exactly. And then you talked also a little bit about purges nationwide or different voter policies. It's also maybe worth mentioning that it got easier to register to vote in Kansas ahead of the last election, which maybe is a question more for your other guest, Anita Austin, because it had to do in part with an online platform that they created that made it easier to register online. And they did, in fact, register thousands of people that way.
Anita, tell me more about that.
Yeah. Excuse me. So the website that was created is ksvotes.org, and it is essentially a digital federal form that is accepted by county clerks all over the state. And through that tool, we were able to register thousands of people. It eliminated problems that were previously had with voter registration, such as like people writing messy, people putting down wrong information, because when you fill something out online, you can't move forward unless it's correct. And so not only were we registering people, but we were accurately registering people.
Well, Celia, we do have to wrap this up, but I'm curious about the questions you are asking, the things you are wondering about as you look at all of this specifically in Kansas heading into 2020.
Well, I think what's going to be interesting is to see to what extent candidates now moving into 2020 court younger voters in Kansas, you know, here specifically. And I think that, you know, we'll be watching who the candidates are as that finalizes. We have a new candidate as of yesterday, for example, in the second congressional district race in Kansas. But
people
then
say 2020 as though it's just a presidential election. It is not just a presidential election.
No, it is not just a presidential election. And I think we're going to have multiple races in Kansas that will be very exciting to watch.
Celia, thank you so much for the reporting on this.
Thank you.
Celia Yopis-Jepson is with the Kansas News Service based here at KCUR. Carolyn DeWitt, Anita Austin, thank you both as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Carolyn is the president of Rock the Vote, and Anita is the program director for Loud Light in Topeka. Up next, how much time with friends is good for you on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're joined by a KU professor who's been studying what he calls social nutrition. And instead of me explaining what that means, I'm going to have him do it. Jeffrey Hall, communications professor at KU. Hello.
Hello. It's good to be here.
What is social nutrition, and why are you studying it?
Yeah, well, so we know from research from a long, long time that basically people who have more social interactions tend to have more positive life outcomes. They tend to have a more satisfying life. They're less lonely, less depressed, feel basically better. And one thing that's very interesting about that is it just assumes that if you just compile more and more and more interactions, that this is a good thing. So one of the kind of fundamental questions that I'm interested in answering, and myself and my co-author, Andy Morella, we were looking to try to understand whether there's sort of a balance, like do we need a little bit of this kind of interaction, a little bit of that, with people who are closer to us, with people who are less close. So the idea is that we actually have a variety of different interactions in our lives of different types and with different people, rather than just more and more and more. And so that was the kind of the motivation of this project.
Well, so, okay, you recently published a paper on all of this. I want you to summarize the key findings and then we'll dig in.
Yeah, so the key findings here really have to go with the idea of what are the unique contributors of each different type of interaction, as I just mentioned. So some of the big findings include things such as that we don't need to have a lot of sort of high intensity, meaningful, affectionate communication all the time, but just a few will do within the course of our day. That the amount of interaction that we have with our closest friends and family really matters for loneliness, but it doesn't really seem to matter as much for things like subjective well-being or life satisfaction. And things like, which was a big finding of this, was things like time we spend by ourselves tell us a lot about a kind of our life satisfaction as well. So if we're very content being alone, if we don't really feel like we want to be in interaction, but we just prefer to be by ourselves, this is a good sign that we're actually having a very well-regulated social system.
So
Can I just ask how on earth you studied any of this?
Well, so there's this wonderful tool that I only happened upon in the last probably about 5-6 years of my own research, but it's been around for a while, and it's called experience sampling. And what you do is that when you enroll people into the study, you ping them several times a day, 5 times a day typically, or sometimes a little bit more than that, depending on the model that you use, and for multiple days in a row. So the first study that we did had 5 days in a row, and the second we had 7 days in a row. And each moment we kind of ping you through your cell phone, we say, hey, what are you doing right now? And if you're in a social interaction, we ask you, what was that interaction like? Who was it with? What modality did you use? And then other questions about the interaction. And if you're alone, we say, how do you feel right now? Are you okay being alone? Would you prefer to be with somebody else? And so the idea here is that we're getting people in the exact moments of their day that they're experiencing the things that they're experiencing. And that's how you study a lot of this kind of in-the-moment kinds of interactions in people's daily log. The other technique we used, which is a diary study, which is people reflect on the end of the day what their day was like. So did you have these type of interactions? How much time did you spend in these different types of interactions? And what did you do with that day? And that was the second of the three studies that we did.
This does all fit into a larger picture you're slowly developing, study by study, of a theory that you call communicate, bond, belong?
That's right. So what my thinking here is that the communicate, bond, belong theory says, what do we do with our social interactions? What are they doing for us? So communication researchers have long known that communication is extremely an instrumental process, in the sense that a majority of what we do are things which are sort of mundane, instrumental sort of activities, things for our job, things for school, things about making plans, things about kind of fulfilling tasks. However, researchers have also said that we have this very fundamental need to belong, meaning that we're trying to find connection with one another. And through our instrumental activities, we're actually oftentimes also fulfilling our needs that have to do with belongingness and a sense of inclusion. And so the communicate, bond, belong theory tries to say what types of interaction work within this homeostatic system. So the idea being is we only interact up until we get our needs met, and then we would seek some time alone or some time by ourselves, because we don't have infinite hours and we don't have infinite energy.
You have not yet addressed FOMO.
Well, fear of missing out is a good example of when you're alone and you feel that you're not being included.
Or you should go home and you stay because you're afraid that the most awesome thing is going to happen the second you leave.
Right. So if you think about that from what the theory would say that the need to belong for an individual who's experiencing that is high, but the amount of social satiation that they're getting through whatever existing interactions is low. And FOMO is often expressed through social media, which in my opinion and other research that I've done is an extremely poor mechanism for getting your social needs met.
Why?
Because it doesn't involve a lot of the things that face-to-face interaction does, which includes a sense of reciprocity or a sense of a person who is being basically paying attention to us, responding to us, and showing us their concern. It's diffused amongst a lot of different people, and oftentimes the people who respond on social media are not our closest friends. And oftentimes it's actually meant as a performative function rather than meant as actually a connective one. And what I mean by that is people often put material up on social media that's meant to be responded to positively by saying, oh, you look attractive, or that was very interesting, or thank you for sharing. But these are not the types of interactions that tend to be nourishing of our need to belong.
Couldn't you say that people do that in person too?
In which way?
Perform.
Absolutely. So performative functions of communication oftentimes are met for the purpose of inclusion. One of the theories that have to do with this idea of where does our self-esteem come from says that we are overwhelmingly motivated not to look good as its own value, right? We're not just endlessly trying to look our best. We are only looking our best in as much that it serves the need of inclusion, meaning we're trying to look good because we don't want to be rejected. So if we sense a sense that other people are going to reject us or not going to spend time with us or not want to be with us, we actually take a limerick of actions to sort of look good, right? To try to perform well or to apologize or to make amends. And some theories about self-presentation really focus on this idea that we perform this way, not for its own sake, but for the sake of inclusion, ultimately.
So increasing, or possibly in some cases decreasing, social interaction I think that that is much easier said than done, right? Our lives are mapped out the way they are in part because of larger forces acting upon us, or at least that's what it feels like. I mean, I will give an example. Forces like automation are going to cut down my human-to-human transactions, which are going to be maybe some of the kinds where it is someone I don't know very well, but I'm just getting that, like, fix of the presence of another human or whatever.
Yeah, we're entering in a time that I think is going to be very curious because in some sense, you know, the arguments from technology is that automation and AI rise, that the amount of social interaction with human beings is going to go down. But the argument also is that frees up your time to be able to do something else, right? That it's more efficient, it's quicker, it's more sort of anticipates your needs rather than you having to like problem solve it with another person.
I want to say that I find, this is maybe just me, but I find myself fumbling with technology in a way that generally consumes the same amount of time.
Exactly. And what's interesting is it usually has to do with our expectations keep rising when we seek more and more from technology. So not only is it frustrating and it doesn't quite work, but then we have to seek workarounds. And when it doesn't meet our expectations or standards, we get frustrated with it. But a lot of times when we have interactions with human beings, because that we're accustomed to the process of having to sort of maintain face and pay attention to another person, that those can actually be quite pleasant. There is some research out there that says that interactions with weak ties or people that we don't know terribly well can contribute to overall life satisfaction and reduce loneliness. And in fact, the study that we conducted, my co-author and I, we found again that the number of social interactions people have during the course of the day, the amount of time they spend in social interaction with weak and strong ties alike, is related to subjective well-being and less loneliness and more life satisfaction.
Yeah, like just standing at the bus stop and talking to another person for 2 seconds about, like, when do you think the bus is going to get here?
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because there was a great study that was done in Chicago, and what they had people do is randomly assign them to either talk to a stranger on the train or not on sort of a train ride into the city, and found that that conversation with a stranger on the train did increase the quality of both the writing experience and also made people feel more connected to their community. So there is something to be said about this idea of these incidental, brief, quality interactions leading to overall life satisfaction and even a better in-the-moment experience. And my research kind of looks at those kind of ideas as well.
We're talking about needing to be social. You have also mentioned the need for alone time. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, so the biggest, I think, and the most surprising finding from this research is that across all three of our samples, the first was, you know, they're all from different states. They are different, collected with different measures, different metrics. Across all of them, the one that ended up explaining the most variance in outcomes, and I mean the most variance in life satisfaction, loneliness, and well-being, was the frequency of moments in your day where people were alone and felt satiated in that alone state, meaning they didn't want to be interacting at that moment where they were alone, that they felt that their needs were met, and that they actually weren't terribly lonely when they were alone. So the experience of being alone is not the same as the experience of being lonely. Those are very, very different things. And what I found really surprising about this result is typically when people study social interaction, they don't study the opposite, which is not social interaction or not interacting. So I would argue that what's fascinating about this is it gives some good support for the concept that we can't just think of more and more and more social interactions being a good thing. It's only particularly bad for people's social well-being, I would argue, when people find themselves alone and have no one to turn to. They have no way of connection. They have no routine interactions with people that matter.
You know, I'm curious. Your finding basically tracks with how I feel like I experience the world, but there's also a lot of talk about introverts versus extroverts, and I've really bought into that as a way of understanding people's tendencies
right.
and like needs for organizing their time and energy in a certain way. The idea that there's some sort of maybe ideal sweet spot on this is shaking my worldview a bit.
Yes, and I would say this research, if it is successful, will help kind of focus the attention on thinking of that as a sweet spot, right? Thinking of well-regulated social systems as being homeostatic rather than linear. Thinking of it, I also appreciate your comment about being intuitive. Like the goal of the theory, as I wrote it, was to kind of capture that sense of intuition to say, well, I don't just always want to be interacting, and some interactions matter than others. And I also don't want to just be always, you know, expending energy to have this experience. It's very taxing. But your very first question about personality, I think, is fascinating because what research from all this history of social interaction research says is that high-quality social interactions are equally beneficial for extroverts and introverts, that it's not personality alone that makes a difference about whether or not people are gaining from having a social interaction. But it has to do, I would suspect, that part of that has to do with whether or not something is sufficiently fulfilling. So think of it this way. If I have high-quality social interaction, and I can also have a whole bunch of other interactions and not be terribly taxed by them, which is a high extroverted person, it doesn't change the that quality interaction benefited me. For an introvert, they may not have extra energy, or they may not be able to interact endlessly without getting exhausted. Yet they still gain from that high quality social interaction they had in the day. And that also tracks on friendship research that says that people who are extroverts have a lot of friends and people who are introverts have fewer, but they can both have high quality friendships.
So this brings me to, we have talked in the past about a study you've done about how long it takes to make a friend, and I wonder if this is related. Because there's a difference between being alone at any given moment and feeling what I would call cosmically alone, as in I have no friends that I could even reach out to when I'm not hanging out with them.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that cosmically alone, I think, is something that we see tracking on to United States populations. You know, they've appointed a ministry of loneliness in the UK.
I feel like I should acknowledge that our health reporter, who is also my husband at KCUR, he's my husband at home, too, by the way, that he did a big project researching loneliness and how it's approached in the UK versus here, not just in the US, but here very specifically in our region.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I would love to hear more about that. I think this is a really serious social concern. I really do. And I think that there are a lot of reasons to believe that loneliness is on the rise. I am publishing a book next year called Relating Through Technology. And in that book, I do an analysis of the amount of time that people spend in social face-to-face interaction over the last 15 years. And this data is from the U.S. Department of Labor. And what I found is that the amount of time people are spending in face-to-face interaction over the last 15 years has gone down about 14 to 17%. And this is from really high-quality data from the U.S. Department of Labor. One of the other things that's interesting about that is that you don't see an increase in time spent talking on the phone or FaceTiming or Skyping or things like that, although we do see an increase of time spent on social media.
I've heard this described as brain hacking.
You mean figuring out what's the right way to kind of behave or spend your time during the course of the day?
No, I've heard the idea of social media algorithms finding ways to just hold our attention as brain hacking. Describe it that way.
Well, I think that they're extremely efficient social mechanisms, right? They're actually, across researchers both in the media psychology terrain and also people in interpersonal communication, they agree they're very efficient. So you don't have to actually do a lot of high energy behaviors in order to see what's going on with other people. From my perspective, this is actually an extension of our kind of desire to just people watch. You know, we tend to enjoy seeing what's going on in other people's lives. But there's a difference between people watching and actually increasing the chance of having an interaction with people. And so yes, it is the case that some of the brightest minds and tons of money are being poured into how more and more time can be spent on social media. But what I'm trying to get at in part is that what happens oftentimes is those neither satiate the need to belong, which is a critical need to be met, nor do they promote social interaction offline. So it's not the case that people who use social media then are following up to spend more time with the people who they're watching. And instead, I think that things like spending time commuting and spending too much time at work are probably the main reasons that people are not interacting with one another.
So if you were to give advice, I know that that's not what academics are usually into doing.
Right.
But like, what are some techniques that seem to have maybe led some of the people you studied to more social interactions despite these larger forces, whereas others haven't quite gotten out of the little hamster wheel?
Yeah, this is a really important question. And I just began a study to look at whether people can be experimentally nudged to engage in behaviors which are good for their well-being. You know, we have to be nudged to do things like exercise and to eat right. I was wondering whether we can experimentally be nudged to actually engage in the kind of behaviors which are more nutritious to our social well-being. So what I did, we did is we had people randomly assigned to these conditions, and many of those conditions were reflective of the findings of this study. And we had people set aside time in a day to have a conversation, you know, to set aside time in the day with joke around with friends or to just catch up with somebody you haven't seen for a while. And what was interesting is within that day, people actually benefited by engaging in these behaviors compared to control groups who are asked just to attend to their social interaction during the course of the day or just to track it, you know, to pay attention to it. And so the idea here is that choosing to set aside time to engage in a meaningful interaction or to joke around or catch up with a friend tends to actually make your days better. And I would say
you have said meaningful interaction. What's the difference between a meaningful interaction and a meaningless interaction?
That's a great question. A couple things on that. One is that meaningful interactions are defined by individuals themselves, because what's meaningful to you and what's meaningful to me are not necessarily the same thing. But meaningful interactions, often when people describe what they are, attend to issues which are personal and important, tend to involve kind of a more sort of thoughtful and more kind of an engaged sort of process, and are done with a sense of volition. You want to be in there having that interaction. So by contrast, many of our workaday interactions or things we have to do for our jobs are not terribly meaningful. They're necessary. And that's a distinction that my co-author and I also try to make, is that we're not going to get away from all those obligatory requirements to socially interact with one another. A lot of those things are absolutely necessary. But if we set aside time for a little bit of high-quality interaction each day, not only does it tend to improve the quality of our days, but this study that we're talking about, it suggests that people who have low levels of loneliness and high levels of social life satisfaction in general engage in those patterns of behavior.
Can I just observe that I think part of why people, at least as I've seen it, turn to social media sometimes for this is because you can't guarantee that when you have set aside that time that someone else who you would have that meaningful interaction with is also just like available right then.
You got it. And that's a big part of this. When I went on various opportunities to talk to the media about my Friendship Hours paper, the one piece of advice that I often said over and over again is to prioritize interacting with people. You know, and I'm not going to even joke. Like, I actually put it on my list of things to do, like to make an appointment to have coffee with a friend or to catch up with them or make a phone date to talk to my friends who live away from me. So I would point out that this is not something that even someone who studies this constantly can do without having to think about it or prioritize it, because I too have obligations in my job and my family and otherwise that may make it difficult for me to prioritize those things. So yeah, setting priorities, following up with yourself, and giving yourself a nudge really tends to matter.
Is in the end, would you say that there is kind of a social equivalent of a food pyramid?
I love that analogy. And in fact, my co-author and I, when we produce this little video to support it, make a similar argument here, that we talk about the idea of a social biome, right? That we have some things which are kind of like always part of the days that we have, but then we set aside certainly high caloric, high quality, you know, nutritious sort of things that are also really matter. And some of those things are things that you would probably guess anyway, right? Spending time with close friends and family, prioritizing meaningful engagement during the course of the day. You know, when basically making a choice to engage or making a plan to take time away from your busy schedule and spend time with people. But what's interesting about that is, just as we know from the nutrition world, it's easier said than done.
If I were to ask you about yesterday, for example, in your own life, like, you know, you said that part of what you did when you reached out to people and you kind of pinged them about, like, what are you doing right now and what have you been doing recently and how are you feeling versus look back at the end of your day, at this day and the interactions you had and how you kind of feel right now. What would yesterday be like for you?
Well, yesterday was kind of a strange day. It was day 17 of being home with my kids, and from being no childcare, no school, you know, we were doing a lot of traveling for the holidays. And I'm sure there's a lot of parents out there, and I'll give a shout out to them that, you know, this is the first day kind of like back to our normal system for those of you who have childcare. And I would say that actually, for me, what kind of cracks me up about that is that I was actually quite satiated, right? I had got to the point where I'd spend a week with my family in Colorado. I spent a long weekend with my in-laws, who I'm very fond of. I spent a lot of time with my wife and my kids. So I'm actually at a place where I feel so filled up, like full of that, and I'm ready to go back to kind of a work system which has more alone time, more kind of time to kind of do work that's more insular and thoughtful. So it fits with the overall idea that we can get oversatiated and we're ready to move on to times that are alone and doing other things as well.
Well, Jeffrey Hall with us from KU, thank you so much as always.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You can listen back to this conversation or anything you missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. Earlier in the show, we talked about young voter turnout in Kansas in 2018 and going forward into this year, 2020. All of it is at kcur.org/centralstandard, and you can talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. Tomorrow, a Kansas City woman has designed a better leotard so that dancers don't have to always be feeling bad about themselves. And all I can say about that is it's about time. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.